Good day, wherever you may be, and welcome to Observations. I've got Kirk here. Maybe Scott will pop in from time to time as well. A couple items in the news, Kirk, I'd like to go over with you. I don't know if you saw it, but in Pakistan, showing the corruption of Allah's religion. In Pakistan, a young girl, a teenage girl, in fact, she was 12 years old. A 12-year-old girl, her brother, not her, her brother was alleged, not shown, not proven, but her brother was alleged to have raped a young girl. And so 20 people from this village of Multan, Pakistan, ordered the rape of the sister, 12 years old. So the solution in Islam for a guy being accused of raping a girl is to have the brother of that girl rape the 12-year-old sister of the alleged perpetrator.
That's so disgusting.
I tell you, what religion does to people is almost unimaginable. Speaking of disgusting, you know there's a California imam who is preaching in Davis, California. You're familiar with Davis?
I'm just not too far down the road.
Yeah, there's a university there. In fact, one of the largest branches of the University of California system is in Davis, which is why this mosque is there. This imam, who gave a sermon called on Allah to annihilate Jews down to the very last one, and asked for the Muslims in the audience to take part in the slaughter. Imam Ammar Shahin gave this sermon at the Islamic Center of Davis, California, this past Friday, a week ago today. He asked Allah to liberate Al-Aqsa Mosque from Israel, the filth of the Jews, as he said. And he calls for a day of judgment between Muslims and Jews. Oh Allah, count them one by one and annihilate them down to the very last one. Do not spare any of them, said this revolting Muslim. An imam.
And it was reported in what context? They said, this is disgusting, in the news.
Oh, Allah, make this happen by our hands. Let us play a part in this. Oh, Allah, let us support this in words and deeds. No, in fact, it was reported by Fox News, but no one else in the mainstream media. It was beneath the New York Times, the Washington Post, the LA Times, which are so pro-Islamic, to mention it. It's a minor
outcry, no from the audience, nothing? Are they just all Muslim audience?
No, it's not a word of judgment. Not a word of condemnation. No call for him to be indicted and convicted. By the way, if you call for the mass murder of a people,
yes,
that is a crime.
Yeah.
That is a felony.
No.
If you encourage, incite a group of people to take
to
part in mass murder,
right,
you are committing a felony. That's not free speech. You are not free to do that. It is a crime. And yet, the imam has not been indicted. There's no calls for his arrest or his conviction.
That's just another sick one. I tell you, y'all come now.
Oh, my. By the way, talking about timing and him coming now and a sickness, this is amazing. Do you know that in all places where records, scientific records are conducted and kept, scientific tests are conducted and records are kept, there's absolute proof that male sperm counts have decreased by 50% in the past 15 years. and that at 50th percentile of what they previously were, they're only within 3 percentile of men not being able to reproduce. 47% of normal is considered at high risk not to be able to conceive. And the male population of all parts of the world where scientific tests are conducted and records are kept has fallen 50%. And 15.
What do you attribute that to?
I don't want to attribute it to anything. I mean, I can speculate, but my speculation is just that. The reason I bring it up is because we are only 9 to 10 years away from the beginning of the tribulation.
Mm-hmm. I agree with
that. We're only 16 to 17 years away from humankind, like this scum of a Muslim, ceasing to exist.
Well,
he's going to get annihilation, but it ain't going to be of the way that he wants it to occur. And he's only going to have his religion first decimated and then annihilated because they're decimated because they flood into Yisrael as a tsunami, as a tidal wave of jihadists raping and pillaging and killing Jews. And that Yahweh himself has to intervene to save his chosen people and his land. And then in the 5 days after his return, commiserate really with his return, Yahweh is very clear he's going to remove from the earth all traces of religion and the religious. So there's going to be an annihilation. But it's not going to be the way that he would hope. And man's going to have nothing to do with it. No, everything to do with it. He's going to be the reason for it. But he's not going to participate in it.
No, and the...
Now, I just want to offer a program note. There will be those who will have turned to this program to get their first appraisal of our response to a man that we talked about at length on this program a week ago and then on the Yada Yah program last Friday evening on the Shabbat, that we had thought we knew and actually liked, who was turned into really a vile man, promoting the worst form of anti-Semitism. You have begun a comprehensive bit of research on the claims that he's making and that are found in his videos. Robin has sent me her analysis. James has sent me his analysis. Robin has done a really thorough job in her analysis of his anti-Semitic claims. And I have pursued a number of things that are pertinent to what he had to say, particularly his affinity for the Septuagint and therefore the Greek Christian New Testament.
And a lot
against
Paul.
Against the Masoretic text and all things Hebrew. And we're going to explore a bit of that this afternoon. As well as doing some research into the actual history of the Septuagint. So people know what they're dealing with. But this program today is going to describe the process that caused the Christian New Testament in particular to be wholly unreliable and in absolute conflict with the anti-Semitic rant of one Fred Snell. And that's what we're going to pursue today. Tonight we will go into the research that has been conducted by those that I have mentioned to dispel the rest of these myths. And you've found some very interesting things historically to refute the Jews aren't Jews conspiracy, as well as the Jews are trying to fleece and enslave and control the world.
Yeah, well, it's not as scholarly as y'all been doing. I've been reading y'all stuff, what I've seen so far. But it's just, look, I'm just an old country kid, but it's pretty, I have a little bit of common sense, and I know how to add things up, and it just doesn't add up on this stuff. Anyway, when we get to that, I'll throw my two cents in, but it's it just ain't so.
Yeah, to be fair,
it doesn't add up at all.
None of us are attempting to be scholarly.
No.
In the sense of elitist, pedantic, or accredited.
Mm-hmm.
What we're seeking is not only the truth, but to do research in a thoughtful, observant manner, discerning between what can be trusted and what is not, what is relevant and what is not, and then making the connections that are necessary to understand so that we can refute the most vile conspiracies and convey Yahweh's perspective. That is all we're attempting to do. That is what you do.
Yeah.
You know, we're not about to claim credentials for doing so, but none of those making accusations have credentials either. What we're claiming is that we know Yahweh, we love Yahweh.
Uh-huh.
We know and love his chosen people and his land, Yahudim and Yisrael, and that we know that he is intolerant, not only of conspiracies and the advocacy of conspiracies, but particularly he is intolerant of those who would curse.
Yeah, he's
chosen people.
Right.
It's the only curse in his words. I think it's the only curse that Yahweh delineates in the Torah. And he has a lot of harsh things to say for a lot of against a lot of religious people and political actors, for sure. But it's the lone curse is that, you know, I'm going to curse those that curse thee. And that is what has been promoted. Now, we would not, and we're going to turn right now to chapter 9 of observations, because it's germane to this discussion. It uses the mistranslation of Nephilim to explore the unreliable nature of the Christian New Testament. And it's a really interesting study, one that is essential if you're going to understand how the myth of Christianity came to be and how it's supported. So all of this is going to be, I think, germane to our discussion.
I agree, yeah, very much.
This begins. There were the Nephilim. I'm reading now from Bereshit, the sixth chapter, the fourth statement. There were the Nephilim. Now that is a literal transliteration of the word. It is a Hebrew word. It is from Nephal. What is the YM?
Plural.
Yeah, it's just like S in English, but you put the YM at the end of a word, and it makes it plural. So the Nephilim would be the plural of Nephil. And it's N, then the PH, Y, and then which is a Yod, and then a Lamed. So Nun, PH, Pe. The Yod and Lamed, followed by a Yod, Mem. The Nephilim, those who prostrate themselves and are stillborn, from the verbal root Nephal, to fall in prayer, to fall in battle and status, going from a higher position to a lower one. Those who are separated and die, those who bow down, falling prostrate, to worship something on the ground. Those who neglect and are neglected, those who attack and conquer in an offensive military action, becoming inferior in the process, those subject to miscarriage and thus untimely death. Before I read any more of this, when you think of people falling prostrate to worship something on the ground, who does that remind you of?
Islam, Christianity, a lot of kneeling.
Well, kneeling in Christianity, do Christians prostrate themselves?
Oh, not the way they do in Islam, no.
No, and they don't bow down, prostrate on the ground, do they?
No.
No. So it's really, we're talking about Muslims here. I mean, I would agree to a lesser degree. Christians bow down, and nafal means to bow down.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, Christianity would be going from a higher position to a lower one by accepting Christianity, just as you would in Islam. But when you when it goes on to say those who neglect and thereby neglected, that could be either one. Both religions neglect Yahweh. They neglect his Torah, and therefore they are neglected by him.
Yeah, but this is really evil people.
Yeah, so then the next part of it is those who attack to conquer in an offensive military action, becoming inferior in the process. You know, Imperial Rome, which morphed into the Roman Catholic Church, was extraordinarily militant and aggressive. And they expanded Rome by being militant and aggressive. The Roman Catholic Church, which is a derivative, the evolution of Imperial Rome, was not as militant as was Imperial Rome. Not because they didn't want to be, not because they were pacifists, only because by 400 CE, when Theodosius declared the Roman Catholicism out of Imperial Rome and to be the Pope of Roman Catholicism and Emperor of the Roman Catholic Church, he didn't have the troops.
No.
You know, the legions of Rome were way too depleted by that time. In fact, the city of Rome had the verge of collapse.
Yeah.
So he was in Constantinople, not in Rome. And so they were not particularly militant. But there is a group of people that not only have attacked Israel, the place that God cares about the most, repeatedly. For example, they attacked it in 1967 in the Six-Day War. And they actually became less. They became inferior in the process, didn't they? Same thing was true in the Yom Kippur War.
Yeah.
They attacked aggressively and were diminished.
Threw everything they had at it and lost it.
Yeah, and they walked away with less than they previously had as a result of the attack. I mean, it is textbook Islam, and of course, what is the signature move of Islam? Suicide bombers, those who, in a miscarriage of life, suffer untimely death.
Yes, indeed.
So that is there were the Nephilim existing in the region, Ha Baha Eretz, in those days. But also, by comparison, in a slightly different form, they existed for some time thereafter. Can you say Islam?
I can. Yes, sir.
By association, the sons of the Almighty came to the daughters of man. This is Baha Adam. The daughters of man, this would be the female offspring of mankind who were descendants of Adam. And the sons of the Almighty would simply be the Bnei Ha Elohim, would be the descendants of Abraham. You know, these are the people who were descendants, not Abraham, but Adam.
Mm-hmm.
And they conceived children for themselves. Now then it's describing the Nephilim with this next statement. These warriors and political leaders, the Gabor, these prominent individuals with the ability to fight, who prevailed in their quest for military and political power, who hailed from a relatively long time ago, are individuals with reputations and recognizable names. So these are the Nephilim. Now, what's interesting is that most Hebrew nouns, as we have learned, are defined by their verbal or actionable root, Nephil, and in the plural, Nephilim, is no exception. It is based on Nephal, those who prostrate themselves and are stillborn. It therefore depicts religious people who bow down in prayer and die as a result. Fully amplified, Nephal describes those who fall in prayer, fall in battle, and fall in status, going from a higher position to a lower one. those who are separated and die. Those who bow down, falling prostrate to worship something on the ground. Those who neglect and are thereby neglected. Those who attack to conquer in an offensive, militant action, becoming inferior in the process. As such, it is similar to Christianity, particularly as it was born out of Imperial Rome, and identical to Islam. It is related to Nephil, which is spelled the same way, just vocalized differently, though subject to miscarriage and thus untimely death. Suicide bomber. I mean, the weapon manufacturing facility for Islam is the womb.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It reveals that the religious conceive stillborn children. Children yearning to die. Since Ha-Nephilim is a title, it should be transliterated rather than translated. Now, the difference is you translate words.
Right.
For example, the word Gabor, which is prominent individuals with the ability to fight who prevailed in their quest for military and political power. These are warriors and political leaders. You translate Gabor. I can transliterate it in the copy so that you know where that what is the source of that definition. But words you translate.
Right.
Elohim, for example, is a word. It means mighty one, and it's equivalent to the English God.
Mm-hmm.
But when it's preceded by the definite article, it's being presented as a title. So the Nephilim, and particularly in this context, it's a title. And titles, we ought to both transliterate, which means to replicate the sound of that name or title in our language, and it's Nephilim. And also with titles, it's wise to translate them so we know the meaning of that title.
Right.
And with names, specific names, which very seldom are preceded with the definite article, ha, we must transliterate them. Now, I've used the example. What is Osama bin Laden in English?
Osama bin Laden.
What's Osama bin Laden in Arabic?
Still Osama bin Laden.
How about in German?
Herr Osama bin Laden.
And Donald Trump.
I'm sorry, it's Donald Trump.
Yeah. It's sorry. Donald Trump. Names we transliterate.
Yes.
You know, that's why it is just so abysmal that Christians have been duped into believing there was a Jesus Christ. That's not a translation.
Let me interject one quick thing. You know, I went through 26 translations.
Uh-huh.
Some of them that you have and some of them that you probably didn't use.
Mm-hmm.
And not one of them did both. I had a couple of them that used Nephilim, and most of them used giants or tyrants or something to that effect.
Yeah.
And none of them did both. None of them would do the title.
Yeah.
Would translate it and use the transliteration.
As I surveyed the most popular translations, I found that that about 80% of the time they were rendered giants. And there's mm-hmm. nothing here that infers that they were big giants. Nothing. There is a Hebrew word for giant. This is not it.
No.
About 10% rendered it tyrants. You know, tyrants is kind of a derivative mm-hmm. of Nephal in terms of, but it's only a diminutive extrapolation because primarily they're religious people. These are people that are bowing down religiously and are off into religious militancy.
Yes.
So these are religious militants is the best way to describe these people. Devoutly religious, overtly militant. They're jihadists.
Yeah. It implies that when they bow down. So
right. So is a jihadist a tyrant? Well, probably the leaders of the jihadists are tyrants. Certainly that imam in Davis, California, he's a tyrant.
Yes, indeed.
But that's not what the word means. So, and then about 10%, if you will, just didn't even try. But, you know, at least they rendered it Nephilim. It's just they didn't leave anybody with an explanation as to what Nephilim meant. And if you don't know what the word means...
Why communicate it at all?
Why communicate it at all? Why tell you that there's the Nephilim in the land unless you go about explaining what Nephal means in Hebrew? I mean, he chose a name. It's God's name. He chose this name for a specific purpose to convey meaning. These were religious militants. In today's vernacular, these were jihadists.
Yes.
Politicized warriors. They were Gabor.
Yes.
Now, the reality is, since the Nephilim is a title, it should have been transliterated and then translated. Transliterated, if you will, and then explained, either within a parenthetical as part of the translation itself or as a footnote or in a collaborative commentary. But there's absolutely no justification for translating Ha Nephilim as giants. There is absolutely no justification for doing so. This error is a legacy of the Septuagint.
Mm-hmm.
One incorporated into the Latin Vulgate and then passed along through the King James Version. Even Strong's, while attempting to justify the KJV, as is their penchant, attributes Nephilim to the verbal root Nephal, acknowledging that it is from their number 5307. And yet 5307 Nephal is the antithesis of giant. It's the antithesis of big. It's the antithesis of standing tall.
Yes.
It's someone bowed down, prostrate on the ground.
Yes.
Someone on the verge of sacrificing their life for their religious zeal. Why can't they get it right?
Well, you can find it if you dig it out, but they won't put it down that way.
Yeah. There's this
everything
rumor,
you said, I've got even more. I mean, it's just, don't need to go into it. We did it once before, but it's there.
Yeah.
I found the word giant a couple of times in some things, but once you put the comma and went to the next one, there's nothing even close to it, and it would be absolutely the opposite.
Yeah, the only reason that you'll find giants in any one of the publications of lexicons is because 100% of those lexicon publications were published by the same people that published giant in the midst of their text, and therefore,
and you got to stick with it.
You got to explain how they got giants.
Mm-hmm.
But that's why you know it's 100% of the time, those that advance conspiracy theories are just incapable of using a discerning filter. You know, they hear something, and they accept it as true. They believe it without bothering to say, is that reasonable? And when you see giant as part of a definition, you realize it's not reasonable. It's wholly inconsistent with everything that the word stands for. Its root, its basis.
Mm-hmm.
You got to use a filter. You got to think through this. Now, since the erroneous nature of the English Bible translations is a product of religion, once we have concluded our evaluation of Bereshit 6:4, we are going to use the errant rendering of Ha Nephilim in English Bibles as giants to explain how these errors originated and why these mistakes are seldom corrected. It is a long and sordid tale, one that deserves our undivided attention. It is impossible to understand how Christianity has managed to survive when it is predicated on an ocean of lies.
Mm-hmm.
If you do not understand how they have come to believe wholly unreliable texts. And that's what we're going to show, is that the Christian Bible publications aren't even remotely accurate.
Yeah.
And we're going to demonstrate
this. Well, I interrupted you. You were going to talk about Jesus. Everybody knows this. It ain't there. There's no J. No. There's Jehovah is not there.
No, in fact, we're talking about the Septuagint here. The error first appeared in the Septuagint. There is this myth that that Fred is being is promoting that Ptolemy was asked and authorized. He says six Jews to translate the Old Testament, I think, from his perspective. And that they went into six different rooms, and when they came out, it was a miracle because there wasn't a single disagreement between them. And that's not what the letter actually says, and the letter is an absolute and complete farce. The letter was written probably 200 years thereafter by a Jew trying to create the impression among pagans, Greek pagans, that that the Torah was an important document. And it actually says that there were six from each of the 12 tribes, which would be 72. I don't know why it's called 70, because that would be 72. But there's a problem with that if you do your history, because around 300 BCE, how many tribes were available to send representatives?
Three.
Three, and of the three, one of those doesn't count, the Lowy, because they would not be called to do something like this. It would just be Yehuda and Benjamin.
Benjamin, yeah.
Correct, that would be it.
That's it.
And so the letter is so fraudulent. It's filled with mistakes like that, where it says, you know, there were six each from the 12 tribes, and of course that would be impossible at that time.
Supposedly they don't know where they are.
Yeah, that's
kind of we'll address that. But
yeah, that's right. We're going to address that, but it would be absolutely impossible. And this notion that they were put in private rooms and somehow came out with an exact same translation, that was written 400 years later.
That's convenient.
By a Christian who was trying to validate the Greek over the Hebrew.
Yeah.
It's the letter, and I'll address it perhaps this evening, perhaps this time next week. But the letter actually is written to a deputy of Ptolemy. That at the time that the letter claims to be written, he was in exile. He had been banished. I mean, it makes so many mistakes, it's utterly laughable. And yet, someone would cite it as a reason to prefer the Greek over the Hebrew. In fact, this person even would have says, you know, that the Dead Sea Scrolls are fragmented. Well, by the way, is the text of the Yeshaya fragmented?
Not at all.
No, in fact,
there's about five or six scrolls. One great, the giant scroll is on display. Oh, look at it.
Yeah, the entirety. I mean, not a single word missing. It's the entire scroll of the longest of the prophets, Yeshaya, Isaiah. And you know, overall, while we do not have all of the Hebrew Torah prophets and Psalms, we have something from every book that is that Yahweh actually inspired, and from many of them, like the Devarim, we have in Yeshaya, we have 8-10 different scrolls. And while it does not cover everything, to call it fragmented when it is a treasure trove of information, I mean, there's
well, when you agree,
thousands of pages of material.
Yeah. When you agree, if there's a word here in different generations and they've written it the same way, it's defined the same way over and over and over and over, and then you hit one little area where that word is not there because of the damage to the scroll, isn't it a pretty good assumption that after 75 times, the 76 is okay? You're probably in good shape.
Yeah, the fact is that the Dead Sea Scrolls compared to the Masoretic text, if you remove from the Masoretic text their vowel pointing, which took place in the 11th century, and just deal with the primary letters themselves, and the Masoretic still has Yahweh's name, they just write Adonai Abibat, so that's not man's addition there, but not in the text itself. It's really just above it. Mm-hmm. But if you compare the two, you'll find that they differ by one word in 14. And I've done the entirety of the great Yeshaya, Isaiah scroll, because we have the entirety, and I can compare it in entirety to the Masoretic text, and it differs in one word in 14. But even then, that's not wholly fair, because they're credited, if you read the Masoretic, the tools will tell you, why HWH is there, but they'll write to the Lord. And so, you sometimes that is an issue. But mostly the vast preponderance of the differences are the form of a verb, whether it is the plural or singular, masculine, or and a word, whether it's masculine or feminine.
Drop the hey.
The pronouns and prepositions. It is, in terms of the message it conveys, it's 99% in agreement. There are some things you can correct in that are worthy of correction and some subtle differences, but it's, collectively, if you do your research, you remove the diacritical marks, you return Yahweh's name to its proper place, and you look at the lessons you can learn from the Dead Sea Scrolls, because there's so much material. You can get the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms within 99% of the original as it was conveyed. It's pretty remarkable. But, the oldest fragment of the Septuagint, would you like to know when it dates? Because people just say, the Septuagint is, is really old. It goes back to this Ptolemy period of, in the 3rd century BCE. It's bogus. Absolutely bogus. The whole letter proclaiming that is a fraud.
Mm-hmm.
There was indeed an attempt at a Greek translation around 200 BCE. The oldest fragment we have is from about 75 to maybe 150 BCE, somewhere during that period.
Mm-hmm.
And talk about fragments. It's about the length of a quarter of one chapter of the body.
Yeah.
That's it.
As a Christian, I was always taught that it doesn't really exist. I mean, there's so little pieces left that you can't even...
No,
that wasn't news.
Right. So, the entire Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, dating to right around 100 BCE, you have a quarter of a chapter. A quarter of a chapter. Out of all of those books. And the next dates to somewhere between 50 BCE and 50 CE. And it's also a tiny little fragment.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what's interesting about both of those fragments is when you come to Yahweh's name, it's not written in Greek.
Are they a placeholder?
No.
No?
No.
Well, it's written
in Hebrew. It's written in Hebrew. If you look at any Septuagint copy prior to about 100 CE, when you come across Yahweh's name, it is written in Hebrew. So they go from everything written in Greek.
Oh,
you know, you got a Greek translation. The name Yahweh appears in Hebrew.
Wow. Good for them.
Yep. The placeholders were used beginning somewhere after 50 CE. So then I would look, since there's so much zeal for this, the myth of the Septuagint being all this wonderful. According to, there's been about 10 very comprehensive scholarly studies of categorizing every copy of the Septuagint. Now, to be considered a copy here, you got to have a significant amount of material. There are some that are categorized here as fragments, like there's a fragment that includes just parts of Job. There are another fragment that is just some lessons from Bar-Rishith. There's let me go through the dates here. I think you'll find this interesting. Now, remember, in the Dead Sea Scrolls, we have many hundreds of scrolls dating between the oldest, about 275 BCE and 75 CE, and they're all written in the original language. They're not translations. They're all written in the original language. And with the Septuagint, you have the oldest dating to 350 CE. What's that, 500 years later?
Mm-hmm.
It's called the Vaticanus.
Yeah.
It contains Genesis 46:28 through Hebrews 9:4, which means it includes a lot of Paul's poison pen. It's in the Vatican Library, of course.
I have seen one of the six copies in the world.
Yep. The next is Alexandrius. So the oldest Alexander copy is dated to 450 CE. It's 50 years after Theodosius made Christianity, Roman Catholicism, the official language of Rome. It says that the complete text of the entire Greek Bible, according to the Alexandrian canon, leaving out five fragments and three or four Maccabees, Odes to Solomon, Psalm 154, and the Epistles of Clement. They leave out the Epistle of Clement, of course, because they condemn Paul. 450. That's 600, over 600 years later. And then you have fragments. There's the Ephraimi from Fragments of Job, 450 CE, the Codex Cotanias, 5th and 6th century, burned in 1731. It had the lessons from Genesis. The Codex Ambrosianio, 5th century, Genesis 31:15 through Yahshua 12:12. 5th century. 4th and 5th century, the Codex Calebto Severinus. Again, Genesis 31:5 through Judges 21:12. Then we go to the 7th and 8th century, Numbers and Judges only. The 5th and 6th century, Genesis with huge gaps. Codex Coeus Lineus, 7th century, 1st, 2nd, and 3rd Kings. Codex Marcianius, 7th century, prophets.
1,000 years now, right?
Yeah. Codex Veronius, 6th century, it's Psalms. Sinaiticus includes even the letter of Barnabas and the shepherd of Hermas.
Mm-hmm.
Welcome to Roman Catholicism.
Yeah.
To trust that is to be wholly ignorant of its history.
How did this happen?
Yeah, and we're going to come into the realization that Origen devoted most of his life to trying to make sense out of how varied these translations were. The translations by the time of Origen were so varied that he created what's called his Hextapla. To try to deduce out of these varied documents that they were no longer even remotely credible, took these five really bad copies, unreliable, and tried to deduce one out of them. And you can't even use that and say, well, at least he made that effort. That was wonderful. Well, no one wanted any part of it, and it was destroyed. No surviving copy, nor any even fragments of a surviving copy have exist today. So that's where you go. So as we're going,
I don't want to hang my soul on.
I'm not either. Yeah, and that was how this Nephilim myth as giants began. It was an error in the Greek translation somewhere along the line, because the Latin Vulgate, Jerome, in creating the Latin Vulgate, as we're going to learn, he was a Greek and Latin, primarily a Latin scholar, but secondarily Greek, and so he didn't know Hebrew, so he translated the old Latin translations, and jumbled them together into one official version, which were all translations of the, at that point, hopelessly flawed Septuagint. And that became the basis, really, of all Bible translations thereafter, because all English translations are really translations of the Latin Vulgate. So, therefore, in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, you're dealing with highly flawed Greek translations of the Hebrew, and then highly flawed Latin translations of the Greek, and then English translations of the Latin, which was a translation of the Greek, which was a translation of the Hebrew.
And a lot of that was Middle English, you know, before they really even got the more modern English. So.
Well, you know, there was, in the sense of Wycliffe created his Anglo-Saxon translation, but his Anglo-Saxon translation was only of the Christian New Testament, the Greek.
Okay.
And in his translation wasn't of the Greek, it was also of the Latin. He wanted to create a version that people in Europe that spoke English, it was Anglo-Saxon at the time, could read. So he translated the Latin Vulgate, but not the mm-hmm. whole of it, just the Christian New Testament into a precursor of English. So the fact is that that I find this interesting is that what follows the HaNephilim in this passage in Bar 6:4. You know, as we have seen, the insight is something that every translator missed. Speaking of these overly religious individuals and of their deadly and militant nature, even of the fact that they were, in essence, killing their own children, in Bar 6:4, Yahweh says, Wagam Aker Ken. But also by comparison, in a slightly different form, they continue to exist for some time thereafter. Now, there's two reasons for mentioning the Nephilim. I've just mentioned one of the two. What is the other one? Why are we being appraised of these overtly religious militants? What's God about to do? What's God about to do?
He's about to destroy him.
That is correct.
Give you a reason why he's destroying
right,
him.
Right, right.
Just like what's coming up.
He told you he grieved of creating man.
Yeah.
This explains why he grieved about creating man. God grieves when religious men are militants. Religious militancy, political militancy, grieves God. You know, this notion of, God support our troops, and of the jihadists, you know, Allahu Akbar. Mm-hmm. That is what grieves God. That's what causes God to say, God, I wish I hadn't even bothered. What a mess these people are. That was the justification for the flood. So that's half the reason for mentioning the Nephilim, why it's important to understand them. Mm-hmm. There's a second reason, and the second reason is given by this last phrase that I've just shared, which is that these people, this Wagam Achar Ken, but also by comparison in a slightly different form, they continued to exist for some time thereafter. God is saying that religious militancy, political militancy, didn't end with the Nephilim. Look at the Babylonians. Look at the Assyrians. Look at the Egyptians. Look at the Carthaginians. Look at the Greeks. Look at the Romans. Look at the Persians. On the other side of the world, look at the Aztecs, the Mayans, the Incas. Look at the Peloponnesians that were so utterly vicious in their human sacrifice. Look at what the Chinese did to their own people. You know,
Mongolians.
Yeah, look at the Mongolians. Look at the Genghis Khan and his ilk.
Mm-hmm.
Look at Imperial Rome. Man.
That's organized.
Vicious. Right. Yeah. Organized slaughter in the name of their gods. Religious and political militancy is what detests God. And he says, so it's going to continue in a slightly different form thereafter. And, of course, it's never been greater than it was in terms of just a perfect fit than Islamic jihadism. But what's the most militant nation on earth, far and away?
Oh, the United States.
Right. And the United States claims to be a religious, God-fearing nation, doesn't it?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, and we're the most militant nature on the history of the earth. So he is telling us about all of this. So indeed, as was the case with Sumer, with Babylon, Assyria, the Hittites, the Canaanites, the Egyptians, the Minoans, the Phoenicians, the Carthaginians, the Greeks, the Spartans, the Romans, the Persians, the Byzantines, the Ottomans, the Indians, the Chinese, Japanese, Aztecs, Indians, and Mayans, et al., they were religious militants, political militants.
Yeah.
Alone, man is bad, but in tribes, nations, and civilizations, he is far worse. Yeah. This is the very point Yahweh will soon make regarding Babel. Not long ago, I was denouncing the savage and grotesquely immoral nature of Rome, calling them the most horrific civilization in human history. By doing so, I was, in essence, echoing Yahweh's perception of them. But my son stopped me dead in my tracks. He agreed that Imperial Rome was more ruthless than any barbarian tribe that they subjugated, and in his estimation, the Roman Catholic Church has been an even greater menace to mankind. But then he asked, can you name a non-religious, non-violent civilization? Kirk?
Well,
he's not me. I would just looked at him at the point. At that
no,
point.
He's right. I could make a case for small little tribes of people like the Aborigines in Australia, or not really.
That's only because you don't know anything about
it. That's about it.
Yeah, and with the small tribes in Australia, it's only because you don't know anything about them. They were illiterate.
Yeah.
They didn't write of their conquests.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So possibly, yeah.
Yeah, in many cases, there wasn't anybody to go fight.
Yeah.
It was pretty
it was tough pretty, on lizards.
Right. Okay, there you go. So you know, you just, I was dumbfounded. No, every human civilization has been uncivilized. A legacy of the Nephilim. So, Yahweh was right. What a clue into the human nature when you translate this correctly. So, rather than looking for giants or oversex spirits, we ought to have been looking at ourselves, at the history of man in group behavior and national behavior. The conclusion of this is misunderstood and errantly translated. And it should have been easy to figure out, as you have already stated, the Nephilim and those who resembled them throughout antiquity were Gibor, warriors and political leaders, prominent individuals with the ability to fight who prevailed in their quest for military and political power. According to God, they were renowned. They were individuals with reputations and recognizable names. They all left their mark on the world, one too often made by weapons of war. To be famous, or in this case infamous, isn't good. God doesn't value soldiers or those who deploy them. They are not heroes in his eyes. They are not valiant. Their might did not make them right. Their fame is their shame. There is no one depicted herein in heaven. Should you believe that I'm projecting my personal predilections with this assessment as opposed to conveying Yahweh's bias and perspective, you may want to consider what Bereshit 6:5 says, the statement that we will consider and track down after we consider the history of Bible translations. So here again, let's read Bereshit 6:4, and then we're going to begin to explore has been done to it. There were for a limited period of time the Nephilim, those who prostrate themselves and are stillborn, falling in prayer, battle, and status, who were militaristic and thus met with an untimely death, existing in the region in those days, but also bearing a resemblance to them in a slightly different form for some period of time thereafter. By association, the sons of the Almighty came to making a habit of pursuing the daughters of men, the female descendants of Adam. And they conceived children for themselves. These warriors and political leaders, prominent individuals with the ability to fight, who prevailed in their quest for military and political power, who were from a relatively long time ago, or individuals with reputations and recognizable names. Now, as I suspected, the long litany of errors, especially the notions of giants, began as an errant translation from Hebrew to Greek by an unthinking scribe composing the Septuagint. Brinton's Septuagint translation of 6:4 reads, "Now the giants were upon the earth in those days. And after that, when the sons of God were wont to go into the daughters of men, they bore children to them. Those were the giants of old, the men of renown." What that scribe did is changed God's word to the point that it made him look stupid. Were there ever giants in the land?
No.
No. Spiritual beings, these sons of God, now they were saying they want to go into the daughters of men. The implication is that they impregnated them somehow. They went into them, possessed them somehow, that caused them to bear children.
Scientific impossibility.
Yeah, that's correct. And Gabor does not make them giants, does it?
No.
I mean, they took two words, neither of which meant giants, and rendered them both giants.
Mm-hmm. That's right. Yeah.
As you now know, there is absolutely no justification etymologically in paleontology, anthropology, archaeology, or ancient history to support changing Ha-Nephilim to giants. There's absolutely no value whatsoever of transliterating the name without explaining it, especially based upon what God told us about them. Factually, the statement, "Now giants were upon the earth in those days," is false. So either the translation is wrong or the author was wrong. And if you believe that man was right, I'll take that wager.
Yeah, well, you got
everything you got. Without an appreciation of what it means to be a son of God, all manner of misconceptions are possible, some of which will witness in subsequent translations. By the way that some people just really go crazy on this is the book that is an utter fabrication, the one that's falsely attributed to Enoch, written sometime around 200 BCE, not during the life of Enoch, which would have been about...
Real.
We're talking about about this time.
Hmm.
He was long gone. Of course, there's no citation from him whatsoever, but to give himself credibility to deserve, the author of the book of Enoch claims, writes in the name of Enoch, even though that is not his name. And he then comes up with a wholly fabricated version of the flood in the time of Noah, but he's the one that came up with this whole spiritual idea that these were spiritual beings that were fornicating with...
A hybrid human,
Yeah. now you go try to find evidence of that. But people believe Enoch. It's just astonishing that they do.
Well, prophecy. I mean, that's the fantasy people. They love weird gods and something.
Yeah,
they do.
Yeah, any kind of myth they're prone to believe.
Sure.
Without an appreciation of what it means to be a son of God, all manner of misconceptions, therefore, were possible. Further, Haya Baha Eretz is much more accurately translated existing in the region than were upon the earth. The phrase Wagam Aker Ken is trivialized, and after that, destroying the reason it was included in the text in the first place. Yah was telling us that the religious and vicious tendency of the Nephilim would continue to exist in other civilizations for quite some time. As usual, he was correct.
Mm-hmm.
Halak, whose primary meaning is to walk, is commonly deployed to convey to go. But bow, which was used here, means to come or to pursue. Moreover, if the intent were to say we're once to go, the verb would have had to have been written in the volitional mood, but it wasn't.
Wait. Yes.
Likewise, el means to. Had God wanted to say in, he would have used ba. Oh, and we are just beginning. There is so much to learn about the history of errant English Bible translations.